and KZFR, Chico listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This is Gail Kimball. You are listening to Ask Dr. Gail. We're on the second Thursday of each month. The last four sessions, with tonight being the fourth, I've interviewed mental health professionals, two psychiatrists, a therapist, and a psychology professor at Chico State. And the reason that I wanted to talk with them for you to learn from is we talked about mental health issues. And we all know that the COVID epidemic, the plague, and the recession that's followed, the being locked in, trying to be teachers and workers all at home is pretty stressful. So the past interviews are available on my YouTube channel as videos, so you can see the people that I've interviewed. And again, we have two psychiatrists local, a therapist, and a Chico State psychology professor. And she's going to be on tonight. Before I get into Cynthia Selby, I wanted to thank our listeners. Ask Dr. Gail is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your local state partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture letter. To stay in the know or have your events listed, visit friendsof.art. Ask Dr. Gail is also made possible by Pullen Cycleway, providing self-propelled transportation and non-polluting recreation. Pullens has been serving the Chico community since 1918. Wow. At 801 Main Street in downtown Chico, and can be reached at 342-1055. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about mental health issues, and I'm thanking our sponsors of Ask Dr. Gail. I want to also thank Baird Roofing Company for a hole in your roof or a whole new roof. Baird Roofing Company has been serving Butte County for more than 30 years. Whether it's an existing structure or new construction, Baird Roofing has got you covered. More information at bairdroofingco.com. They can also be reached at 342-1631. We also want to thank Members First Credit Union, created by the community for the community. Members First is a member-owned, not-for-profit financial institution providing checking, savings, loans, and credit cards to residents of Butte, Glen, Shasta, and Tehama counties. For more information, visit m1cu.org. Or you can just search Members First Credit Union to get involved. I really think they do a good job. Before we start talking with Dr. Selby, I wanted to tell you about a new resource. I've been busy during this time of more time at home, shall we say, and I have a new book out called Calm, How to Thrive in Challenging Times, and it's available. And then shortly, a companion book called Calm Parents and Children, a guidebook, will be available. And it has everything I know about how to stay grounded, centered, achieve your goals, that kind of thing. So I thought that it might be useful to do a visualization with you. And I'm really a fan of visualizations because they're a way of harnessing the power of thought. Our thoughts are extremely powerful. There's many, many studies done by scientists like Dean Radin, who's written a lot of books about his experiments and others. And they find things like if I stare at a picture of you and you're in another room, when I stare at your picture, your video, your body reacts. And when I don't stare, your body reacts a different way. We've probably all experienced having someone look at us from behind, and we turn around and see who's looking at us. Or Dean Radin, you might want to try this. He's done experiments with food. So you take a bunch of chocolate candy, divide it into two, and one batch you set aside, and the other side you charge up with to be tasty and yummy and invigorating and just the best chocolate that you've ever tasted. There's different ways to do this, but we know from many, many studies, intention is the key to using the power of thought. So if you intend that this is very special chocolate, it will have an effect. So try it out. And what you do is ask people who don't really know what you're doing to taste the two different batches of chocolate and rate it, say, on a scale of 1 to 10. And then see if the special chocolate that you've put your intention into has more, is more flavorful or more enjoyable to the tasters. People have also done that with tea, where Buddhist monks blessed a batch of tea and not the other. They've done it with wine. Some of these are discussed in my Mysteries of Healing and Mysteries of Knowledge Beyond the Senses, where I interviewed visionary scientists to tell us about what's really real and how we move forward. So let's do a visualization to achieve a goal. So let's make it simple, like to have a really enjoyable rest of your time awake. And so what you do is visualize, let's say, a balloon. And you write in the balloon, enjoyable day ahead or night ahead, whatever your time zone. And then you put in there the feeling of, yes, I'm going to have the most enjoyable day I can remember. This is great. Then you imagine a little cord on the balloon, and you set the intention. You visualize anything that stands in the way of this goal goes down the cord. Whew. Down it goes. And then you fill the balloon 100% with amusement. And you can be aware of how you do that. Do you see it? Do you hear it? Do you feel it? We all have different kind of modes by which we learn things. And then fill the balloon 100% with enthusiasm. This is really going to be an enjoyable few hours ahead. Yes. And then imagine that your fairy godmother drives up in her pumpkin coach, and she gets out with her wand and fills your balloon with 100% of sparkly gold miracle dust to energize the goal. So then let go of the cord. Imagine that the balloon becomes a helium balloon, and it goes off to do its work. And then the last step, which is important, is to imagine a gauge from 1 to 100. And I'm going to ask you a question and see what percentage lights up for you, or you hear or feel or sense or know, depending on your modality. So the question is, how much permission do you really give yourself to achieve this goal of an enjoyable time ahead? And if it's not at 100, you can move it up as far as you possibly can where it feels like it's moving. Okay, so this visualization, obviously, it's imagery, it's not literal, it's not magic, it's just a convenient way to focus your thoughts. So you can let me know what you experience. I'm at gkimble@csuchico.edu. All right, let's hear from Cynthia Selby. She talks about mental health issues. She talks about autism and how girls are often not discovered.
And all of those are, you know, single-use disposable plastics. And some of my friends that do, like, ocean, like, they test waterways. And,
you know,
they've already found, you know, gloves
this
and masks on the ocean
Cynthia
just
Shelby.
In the past, you know, few months. And
this is Hannah Testa. We had a little mix-up here, but this is a great interview. Hannah is 17. She lives in Georgia, and she's a climate activist. She's been an activist since she was in kindergarten. And here she is talking about her new book and plastic pollution. Sorry about this mix-up, but here it is.
Hey, single-use plastics, you know, the safest material to use, which isn't proven true, and research even shows that Corona lasts longer on plastic than any other material. It'll last in there for several days compared to some other materials. It's just a few hours. And so it poses a huge threat to with our waste production because oil prices have dropped. And plastic is made of oil, so it's actually cheaper to produce new plastic than recycled plastic. And recycling facilities, a lot of them aren't running right now either because of, you know, health and safety concerns, you know, touching our secondhand stuff. So the production of plastic has gone up. So there's a lot of things, you know, I definitely didn't consider, think about with the pandemic. But there's a lot of issues. And actually with air pollution, all the plastic that's used kind of like on the front lines of the virus, like, you know, the testing kits or the masks and gloves or you know, the suits they have to wear, all of those are actually being incinerated. And that is obviously not very good, especially for the communities that are living in those areas, and mainly they're lower income communities. And there's so many long-term health impacts, and a lot of times they can't even afford, you know, to maintain the symptoms that they have. So there's a lot of problems just with our waste that we aren't seeing. And I think it's important to highlight, especially because everyone does think, oh, you know, the world is healing. We're doing so much better. And we are. But from a waste perspective, it has actually gotten so much worse.
When you just think of all the PPI that health professionals are wearing, and they want to be able to change it all the time. So just that waste alone is enormous.
Exactly. There's so much of it, and it's so hard to wrap your mind around, like even hand sanitizer bottles, you know, and there's just so much plastic with this pandemic that we're using and then throwing away. And so the best solution is really just, you know, trying reusable, like, gloves and masks to wear instead. Try and reduce the amount of plastic packaging that you get when you online shop. Try and get from you know, sustainable companies that use, you know, paper or other sustainable packaging. And it's kind of hard to avoid everything, especially with takeout. Takeout has definitely been harder because a lot of restaurants don't want to touch your, like, reusable containers if you bring them in. But, you know, just trying to do the best that you can, every little bit does help. But right now it's a lot harder to, you know, live single-use plastic-free.
What I read that I'm not clear about is that it's really hard to recycle plastics that have food on it that we've used that are contaminated in some way. Tell us about that. How does that work?
Of course. So recycling as a whole is kind of a broken system for plastics. For other materials like aluminum and paper, recycling is great. But plastics has never really been a great product to recycle. And as you mentioned with food, sometimes it's like labels or caps or stickers, you know, it kind of makes them unrecyclable because a lot of times they don't want to waste workers' times to be cleaning stuff or, you know, taking off these items. So it's just easier and more efficient for them to throw it away. And even just with plastic, they need a buyer for these materials. And there's 7 different types of plastics with different, you know, chemical compounds and compositions. And so if there's not a buyer for some of those numbers, they throw it away. And a lot of those numbers usually don't get recycled. Mainly 1, 2, and sometimes 5 gets recycled. The rest are almost automatically thrown away. And so a lot of times, especially when I was younger, you know, you hear in school, oh, recycling's so good. You know, they're going to turn it into like a bike or a bench. And I always thought I was doing my part. You know, oh, if I use this plastic, it's okay because I'm going to recycle it. And it's kind of been that out of sight, out of mind ideology. When you look into it, you're like, oh, this is still a part of the problem. And even with plastics, a lot of times when we recycle it, we don't recycle it here in America. A lot of westernized countries, we actually send it to other countries, especially in Asia, for them to deal with and recycle. And it's the conditions for there are absolutely terrible. There's this documentary on Amazon Prime called, I think it was Plastic China, and it's talking about how, you know, we ship, not anymore, but we used to ship majority of our plastic to China, and the facilities of their recycling centers are terrifying. It's absolutely terrible. You know, it's a human rights issue for those people. And one of my friends, she actually lives in East Java, Indonesia. Her village is absolutely destroyed by our plastic trash we send there to be recycled. She lives almost in a slum of our plastic trash that we're sending for them to deal with. And it's polluting the river that they live on. You know, they rely on this water for drinking water, for bathing, for cleaning. And her and her family, they've been huge spokespeople for their village. They're in the, I don't know if you've seen the new documentary, The Story of Plastic. It's a new documentary, but it's absolutely wonderful, talking about how plastic is honestly a huge threat at every stage of its production, not just even at the pollution stage at the end of its life, but through every step of the way. But it's crazy to see how, you know, we, as these westernized countries are like, oh, this isn't our problem anymore. Now we're going to send it over there for them to deal with, and we'll call it recycling. And I remember I actually was testifying for a local ordinance, and I was the last speaker to help pass a local ordinance on single-use plastics in our community. And someone else earlier speaking out against the bill and saying, most of the plastic in the ocean, you know, it isn't coming from us. It's not our problem. You know, it's mostly Asian countries. You know, it's coming from their coastline. So we don't need to pass anything. That was like his concept of it. And thankfully, I was speaking after him. So I quickly like rewrote and added stuff in my speech. I was like, actually, we send our trash to Asia. So it is our problem. And thankfully, that bill did pass. But yeah, it's just a lot of things we don't think about and it's kind of covered up. There's a huge waste problem when we're sending our stuff away. So recycling, you know, we've always been taught it's the best solution, but really it isn't. We want to stop it from the source. Like recycling and cleanups, they are good, especially like when they're effective. But only 2% of plastics is effectively recycled. The rest are either downcycled, and that's like 10% of all plastics is downcycled. But the rest, you know, are all ending up in our landfills or in our oceans.
What does downcycled mean?
So downcycled means when you take plastic and you try and recycle it into something new, it's a lesser quality of what it was originally. So with paper, you can recycle and recycle and recycle and constantly turn it into something new. Same with aluminum. But with plastics, most of the time, you can't really do that. So when you like melt it and reform it into something new, it'll be more brittle and not as good of a quality as it originally was. So if you recycle it again, it probably would be even less quality if they even recycle it. They might even just throw that away just because it's such a poor quality. So plastics cannot be constantly recycled and reused. So it makes it, you know, a terrible product to recycle.
I read somewhere about a kind of a bacteria that can decompose plastic. Have you heard of anything like that?
I haven't, actually. I know there's a lot of research on trying to find solutions to decompose it. I've heard of, like, I think there was, like, a fungus or something that was decomposing it. But I honestly don't know enough about that research.
Yeah, that would be, we should follow up on that. I'm thinking in terms of the pandemic that, as you said, people are doing a lot of takeout, so they don't sit in a restaurant. And styrofoam, it looks like it has a little...
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. This is Gail Kimball. You're listening to Ask Dr. Gail. We had a little mix-up in terms of who our speaker is today, but it's Hannah Testa. She's 17, a climate activist, has a new book coming out soon about plastic pollution, and she's amazing. She's in Georgia and really has done an incredible amount for being 17. Well, we'll listen to Dr. Selby next month.
Kind of porous. Thank you. Like a sponge. So that's like if you have a plastic container and let's say you put a curry in it and it has that like orangey tint left, that's because it soaks up some of the stuff that we put in it, but it also releases stuff into our food as well. So, like, especially, like, hot or cold food on styrofoam, it actually leaches toxins into the food that you're eating, which is, you know, very scary. And there's still a lot of research being done on the health impacts. But, you know, they're saying it could lead to cancer or obesity or diabetes. There's so many health implications that they're looking at, which is terrifying to think about. You know, if we're putting, you know, our hot food, our hot takeout in these styrofoam containers, and there isn't a ton of legislation on styrofoam, but it's definitely one of the worst for our own health, but also to be recycled. And it's a huge pain in cleanups because it's like brittle and it crumbles so easily. I remember I went to my local lake and you just see the tiny little styrofoam balls all on the shoreline because, you know, people were just, I guess, dumping it out from the lake on their boats. And it's a huge hassle to clean up.
What are alternatives for containers and, well, straws, we know, metal, paper, plastic bags, use cloth, face masks, cotton or whatever. What are alternatives that you would like to see more widely used?
Yeah, so definitely I usually like to bring my own containers to reduce any waste at all. But if there's, some restaurants have, you know, paper takeout containers or some even have bamboo, there's a few different alternatives, but not many restaurants have those. So the best thing to do is bring your own containers, but if you can't do that, especially during the pandemic, it's harder. Reach out to the manager or the company and ask them to consider having a sustainable alternative in place instead. So it's not just even for you, but for everybody. And also talk about, if you talk about the health implications, I think they'll be more eager to make that change because, you know, if you think of the environment, for us, you know, that's really touching to us, but that's not, you know, everybody's main focus. But if you talk about, like, health issues, that's when they're like, oh, you know, that could be a serious problem because that's more personal to everybody. So if you reach out, same way with straws, like if you see people with plastic straws at, like, giving out at restaurants, you know, talk to the manager and ask about, you know, not automatically giving them out or using paper straws instead. Simple things like that, you know, it's not only just, you know, that one straw, but they use so many every day just alone. And you can only imagine, you know, if they make that shift, how much they'll save.
Mm-hmm. To change the subject a little bit, there's a big push because of the presidential election in November to get the Democrats to commit to the Green New Deal and a tough climate policy, and it looks like the Democratic Central Committee is kind of resisting committing to the kind of policy that the Green New Deal would like. What are you hearing about the politics of climate change?
That's a good question, and honestly, I don't know a whole lot, especially since the lockdown, the pandemic, I know a lot has kind of slowed down and a lot more focus has been on the pandemic as well as Black Lives Matter movement and kind of passing legislation for those two bills. And I know everything else has kind of been put on the back burner. So I don't know a whole lot on the Green New Deal and climate-wise, but I do know a bit on, there's a new bill, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act that was introduced I think it was early February of this year, and I actually got to go to DC and help introduce it. But it's the first national bill regarding plastic pollution here in the U.S., and it put more pressure on the producers of plastic than on the consumers. You know, oh, like, take your own reusables, or, like, it's your problem, you know. But instead, putting pressure on them to either make changes or take back the plastic that they produce for their consumers. And so that would be a huge win for us if we get to pass that. But like I said, everything's kind of slowed down with the lockdowns and the Black Lives Matter movement. But I will definitely keep you updated.
Were you able to testify? You were able to go to D.C. in February?
I got to help introduce the bill. So we had like a press release kind of event, like a press event, and I actually got to go to the Capitol, and there were six members of Congress that spoke, and then a few different activists spoke as well. So I got to speak, which is really very crazy for me. I never would have imagined, like, I'm not even a voting age yet, but it was truly like such an incredible moment, especially for young people. I kind of spoke on my speech on behalf of all young people, saying that, you know, this is incredible to be able to pass that, especially for our generation and for generations to come. So that was really, you know, amazing for me to be able to have that experience. But yeah, everything's been kind of put in the back burner, but we still need a lot of support on that bill, especially. It's great to reach out to your members of Congress, or, you know, different candidates that are running for Congress, or if your member of Congress is running for re-election, you know, definitely reach out now. I think now is one of the best times to do that, because they want to get, you know, everybody's vote. So they want to listen to what their constituents have to say. Because I reached out to my member of Congress, but he's retiring, and he was like, no, this is a huge issue for me. And I was like, okay, that's fine, but you're leaving. So I'm focusing more on, you know, the people that'll take his place, because that they want to listen more now to get our votes. So that's something you can do today, is reach out. See if your member of Congress is supporting the bill already and signed on. If not, you know, send them a message. And the best thing to do is make it personal to them. Like for me, I talked about, you know, our lake and our rivers that everyone in our community loves. Everyone loves going out and spending time there, because we don't have a beach. If you have a beach, that's probably the best thing to talk about. But we were just talking about how everyone loves the lake, and, you know, you want to keep it clean and pristine, you know, for your kids and your grandkids and for my generation. So as you can make it as personal as possible, it'll definitely, you know, pull at their heartstrings and hopefully get them the support, because we need bipartisanship on this bill before we can get it passed.
In your book, you start out by talking about kind of advocacy you did in the state, Georgia State Capitol, and that you thought that since the previous speaker they weren't paying any attention to, it was really a surprise to you when you started speaking. They're like, oh, and they're actually listening and paying attention. Do you think that's a strategy that youth can use in making change?
Most definitely. I think a lot of times young people think, oh, like, I'll wait until I'm older, and kind of have that mindset, like, you know, as a young person, I can't do much, or they won't listen to me. And I will say I was definitely one of those people, for sure. And that moment was definitely, you know, life-changing for me, just because I just remember standing there and seeing this. She was a great speaker, but and nobody was paying any attention to her. And I was like, oh my gosh, they're not going to listen to me. There's no way. You know, I've been preparing so much. This means so much to me, but they're not listening to her. Like, they're not going to give any attention to me. But to have, you know, the whole room's attention, you know, really showed me that young people have a voice. And, you know, it's now young people are finding their voice as well. Like, you see Greta, you see so many other youth activists like Jamie Margolin, Genesis Butler, so many other young people speaking up on issues they're passionate about, and they're being heard, especially by adults and change makers. You know, and it's really impactful, because when I was younger, I didn't really have a whole lot of role models to look up to that were young people. I had Malala that I looked up to, but that was really the only young person I could really look up to. But as a young person, I think it's kind of funny to see how shocked people can be. I think a lot of times they're like, oh, you know, it's this girl, she's probably from the Girl Scouts, you know, or this is a school project. They already have a predetermined idea of, you know, how it's going to go. And honestly, it's funny to watch their reaction. They're like, oh, wow, she really knows what she's talking about. Like, she's really passionate about this. And so I think as a young person, it's a huge tool to be able to speak up, because not only is it different for adults to listen from kids, because they're so used to hearing from other adults, but also for young people to see somebody just like them speaking up as well, because usually they're used to hearing adults telling them what they can do, and that's how they have that mindset, I can only do that when I'm older. But when they have these role models and young people to look up to, that's when they can be like, oh, I can do that. That's, you know, they're just like me.
You know what I thought was, I really got a kick out of this, the TikTok and K-pop activists who had an influence on the planning for Trump's inaugural rally for his campaign in Tulsa last week. I don't know. I think they had a big impact. What do you think?
For sure. And I remember, me and my friends, we have like a group chat, and every time he does events like this, we text each other. We're like, here's the link, sign up, you know, save some seats. And it's crazy to finally, you know, see how big of an impact that has had on these rallies, because there's been young people doing this for several rallies, but I think this has definitely been the biggest impact we've had. And I think, honestly, it was because I think Donald Trump was so set and vocal and like, oh, we're going to have a million people there. Because like having, I think it was around 6,000 people there, is actually still quite a lot of people, especially during the pandemic. But I think what made it so great was the fact that they were so excited to have so many people there and announced it so much. And for them to be completely wrong and to have all these young people, you know, be the masterminds behind it is incredible.
Are you on TikTok? Are you a K-pop fan? How did you know about the this kind of tactic?
Yeah, I do go on TikTok. I don't really have a TikTok account, but I do watch videos on TikTok. It's actually, what's crazy, it's actually become one of my main sources of, like, political news from a lot of young people, which is funny. There's a lot of young people, you know, talking about you know, political issues, and then obviously I do my own research as well to verify whatever they're saying. But it's actually been a great tool to get the word out on a lot of different issues. So it's been really interesting. But that's where I found out about it, and some of my friends as well. But yeah, there's a lot of things that happen on TikTok for sure.
Well, you can only have a minute mm-hmm. that you upload, right? So people have to have a really powerful minute.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, they vary a lot. Sometimes it's a video. A lot of viral videos happen on TikTok, whether it's filming protests and like what's actually happening and not what the media shows, or showing, I think recently a video came out that I saw of, you know, those very like Karen kind of moms, just, you know, how do I describe it? What was she doing? I think she was calling this guy the N-word and just being like absolutely terrible and racist to him. And he pulled his phone out and was recording her, and she backed off and she was like, you're attacking me, you're attacking me. And that video went viral. And so it's like, it's really great to see, kind of like the easiest way to make videos viral is like any kind of video to get the word out. You know, TikTok's a great resource for that, to kind of show these videos, but also you can do educational videos. It could just be a video of me talking about how other people can support causes. Like some people talk about, you know, GoFundMes for like Breonna Taylor and how you can support, or they have links on, you know, Black-owned businesses that you can support as well. So there's a lot of resources, a lot of information, and it's all video-based, all videos that are posted. But it's been a game changer for sure for young people.
How interesting. Well, what if there's some juicy 5-minute video of some kind of confrontation or something? Is there a way that you can see more than 1 minute?
You can post, if you wanted to do, like, split it up into 5 videos and do, like, part 1, part 2, because people do that, like, have, like, part 1, part 2 is coming up next, then kind of splice it up, or you can just kind of edit the best parts into 1 minute if you can, But yeah, that's what most people do.
You've raised thousands and thousands of dollars for good environmental causes, and a lot of people would like to know, I'm sure, how you do that. What works in terms of fundraising for good causes?
Yeah, there's a lot of different tactics. For young people, I think what's definitely powerful is social media, just because we're so tech savvy. And especially with the pandemic going on, it's hard to do like physical like fundraisers, like an event. So social media is definitely a great tool, like GoFundMes, things like that, or doing petitions like change.org petitions. But fundraising wise, social media has definitely been a huge game changer. Also just getting people to show up. But when I do fundraisers, like event wise, my favorite fundraiser I did was like a one night event. It was like a movie night. And I just had a ton of my classmates help me, so we can kind of plan it up, for the next few months. And we really just try to spread the word as much as possible, whether it was, you know, making posters and putting it out for people locally to see, or, we definitely posted on social media. We reached out to our local newspaper articles. And there's a lot of online, websites that, you know, you can write, you know, like, events for people to go to. So that was really helpful for sure, just spread the word out as much as possible. And we didn't have like a register, like a place to register or anything. It was just like, you know, come and show your support. So we had no idea how many people would show up. And that was honestly quite nerve-wracking. Yeah. The day before, we were like, oh my gosh, what if like nobody shows up? But we had over 300 people show up, which is crazy for our small little community.
That was for movie night. And what were the movies?
So it was just one movie. It was actually, so this was a few years ago, and I used to love American Girl dolls, and it was for a horse farm. And I knew that, you know, young girls, they love horses and they love American Girl dolls. And their doll of the year, they made a movie about her, and she had a horse. And it was kind of about her and her horse. And so I thought that'd be perfect to show and get people to go there. And just watch the movie. And so we raised that night, I think it was over $2,500 just in those like few hours. And we also actually, the newspaper article we wrote, someone from CBS saw it and wanted to do a story on it. And I talked about how the horse farm on a good month, it costed like $10,000 for like necessities, like food, water, like without any, you know, major surgeries or anything, that'd be like $10,000. And so someone saw that and anonymously wrote a check for $10,000 for the farm. So that was really incredible too. But yeah, so it was just, that was a few of the things that I did. I haven't done any major fundraisers since. But from my experience, I think having personal in like personal events is definitely more impactful, especially for the horse farm, because people got to be at the sanctuary and see the horses for themselves, and kind of see, you know, what they've gone through, instead of just doing it like, you know, at my house where it wouldn't be as impactful.
What about your campaign to get Starbucks to rethink their disposable, supposedly disposable coffee cups and stuff? How that is, that wasn't local, which we have been talking about. It's international, I guess. How did you work to influence them?
So there's a coalition of around, I want to say 15 organizations, and we all got together, and because there was research showing that, you know, they're paper cups, and like paper cups you always see at Starbucks, you think that when you recycle it, you know, it's going to be recycled because it's paper. But actually, because it's lined with plastic on the inside to help, you know, seal it with our hot drinks, it actually makes it impossible to recycle, which is crazy, because it's just the mixed material that they have. And I had some students put trackers on those paper cups because Starbucks claimed that they were recyclable and they had recycling stations in their stores. And so they put the trackers on the cups and put them in the recycling, and every single one ended up in the landfill. So we got petitions running, And with all of our organizations together and trying to blast out as much as we could, we got over 1 million petitions signed to try and convince Starbucks to create a more sustainable paper coffee cup. And we got their attention. Eventually, we actually had an event in Seattle. I couldn't make it because it was during my exams, but they had like a protest out in front of the Starbucks headquarters, and we had a paper cup like monster outside their office as well. And we had the 1 million petitions, and they agreed to, they actually decided to invest $10 million into finding a more sustainable paper coffee cup. We haven't heard any news about what that new coffee cup looks like or where that's gone since then. But we're still trying to put more pressure on them, you know, to do something as soon as possible. But yeah, and since then, they've announced, you know, that they aren't going to use the straws and they have those lids and they're going to be more eco-friendly, which is awesome.
That's really wonderful. Yeah, you've made a huge difference. Is there anything else that you'd like people to know about your book or work that you're doing now?
Yeah, if you want to know where to order my book, if you go to handforchange.org, I have a section right, if you scroll down just a little bit, it's right there. I'll give you the link to where you can pre-order. And Hannaford Change is my website, and all of my social media handles is just Hannaford Change with the number 4 in the middle.
Oh, I wanted to ask you one thing that I didn't understand from your book. You said a lot of our clothes contain plastic. Tell me about that, because I try to buy cotton or wool or natural fabrics.
Yeah, definitely. That was something that shocked me, but some of our clothing actually contains plastic. It's called polyethylene. So if you look in our, like on your tags, it's kind of what makes stretchy clothing. So like yoga pants or some t-shirts, it's this really stretchy kind of fabric because it's made of the plastic materials and those threads. And like all, you know, materials and clothing, it sheds naturally. Like if you put it in the wash, you're just wearing it out. But especially in the washing machine, it's pretty harmful because these fibers are so small. When they wash out, it doesn't get filtered because they're so small, and they end up just going straight into our rivers and our oceans when you put them in the washing machine. So that becomes a huge problem. And unfortunately, there's a lot of, not a lot, but there's some brands that are, you know, making sure it's like, oh, this is from recycled bottles or this is from trash we cleaned up, which is always great. You know, supporting that cause, but also that's creating its own problem itself, you know, putting the plastic back into our oceans. So that's something I definitely didn't know. But just doing something as simple as, you know, checking your tags before you buy something. That's what me and my mom do. We're like, oh, we like this shirt. And we're like, oh, never mind. You know, we'll find a different one. And not every shirt has it, which is great. There's a lot of, most shirts don't. But it's always good to check to see, you know, if there's these synthetic fibers in your clothing before you purchase it.
I've also read that cotton production is really polluting.
It
so,
is.
You know, I think, oh, 100% cotton, that's great, but it's not, right?
Yeah, it's a struggle. And I actually reached out to my friend. She focuses on sustainable fashion. And I was like, what exactly dictates a sustainable fashion? And she goes, it's very complicated because you look at, it's really just a lesser of two evils because, you know, if you think of the plastic side, you know, that's obviously a huge problem. Like if you look at cotton, you're like, oh, it's such a huge, it uses so much water. And there's so much, you know, there's a big carbon footprint with that. And so there's always like, it's very hard with fashion. And so the easiest solution, usually be sustainable in fashion is really, you know, to stop buying from fast fashion and try thrifting, buying secondhand as much as possible. But if you're looking more at the material side of it, like plastic, just try and avoid those materials in your clothing.
And some people are taking used clothing and designing it into new kind of fashion. Is there a name for that?
Repurposing? Yeah, repurposing it. Yeah, there's a lot of people, especially on Pinterest, that are kind of like cutting up clothing and resewing it into different things, which is very sustainable instead of, you know, it ending up being thrown away as repurposing it into, you know, a new article of clothing or something else for like your house or for cleaning or something like that.
I really like, I get all my clothes from secondhand stores because there's more variety. Like they'll have, if you go to a department store, it's this year's fall colors are 1, 2, and 3, and they're all the same.
And exactly.
If you, you never know what wonderful thing you're going to find in a thrift store.
Ah, it's like a treasure hunt every time. But yeah, especially major clothing, it can be really wasteful because once something's out of fashion, a lot of times they just throw it away. Like it'd be more sustainable even to just give it to homeless people or, you know, donating it somewhere where it could be put into use. But a lot of them have research has shown that they just throw it away or they burn it because they don't want anyone else having their clothing.
So much work, Hannah. Let me last question. Tell me again how you stay motivated in the face of such huge obstacles.
Yeah, it can be challenging sometimes for sure, especially like, you know, my algorithm on social media is like all this work. So it can be really overwhelming because everyone I follow, all the stuff I look at is like environmental or it can be really depressing and overwhelming. But I think just doing the work that I do, even though I don't always see the impact I make, but whenever there's someone that tells me like, oh, because of you, like I've made this switch, or anyone tell me they feel inspired, that always motivates me to keep going. And even just my family and friends, you know, helping uplift me sometimes when I'm down. Because a lot of times I don't get to see, you know, the impact I make, you know, on people. And that can be kind of hard sometimes. I'm like, oh, like, I don't know. Like if I'm talking to a group of students, my goal is, you know, hopefully to inspire at least one person out of that whole group of students. And you never know what they'll do with it and who they'll inspire along the way. So that's what really motivates me to keep going, because there's always so much to be doing, you know, it never ends, unfortunately, but every little bit counts. Every little bit counts. So don't let that discourage you because it can be overwhelming for sure. If you look at these big issues like climate change and plastic pollution, they're huge issues. And as one person, you'd be like, oh my gosh, like this is so overwhelming. This is too much. But every little bit does make an impact. And as one person, you can have such a huge impact on other people, on businesses, on legislation. And there's a huge power in numbers as well. Like if everyone thought, you know, they could make an impact, then nothing would ever change. But even if you see with the Black Lives Matter movement, all these people are coming together. You know, they're all individual people, but the fact that we're all coming together for these protests, to sign these petitions and put pressure on the police department, that's when we're starting to actually see real change. You know, it just takes that one email or that one more signature on that petition or supporting, you know, Black-owned businesses. You know, they all make such a huge impact. So don't try and feel discouraged.
Okay. To me, what seems like really important that you young people 18 and over can do is vote, but they have a history of being the least likely to vote. And I know Georgia recently had a big fiasco in their voting, made it so hard for people, I guess because of Governor Kemp. That's kind of his plan. What is your strategy for getting people to vote who are young and progressive?
Yeah, it's interesting for sure. But I think especially more Gen Z youth are interested in politics and more interested in voting. I think there's 4 million young people that are turning 18 before the election that are going to register to vote. You know, that's a huge number of young people. And, you know, they can have a huge sway, especially locally on our representatives. It's just a matter of trying to get as many to show and register as possible.
But why do you think they don't? It's like, I'm too cynical, I don't have time. What do you hear people say as to why they didn't vote?
I think sometimes my vote doesn't matter. And I understand that, like, if you look at the bigger scale, like because of the Electoral College, but locally, you know, that does make a huge impact on your local representatives. Some people really just don't care. They're like, I don't really keep up with politics, or, you know, it doesn't really impact me, but it does. you just aren't really paying attention to it. And I don't know, it's hard to try and get people to care. But a lot of times, you know, politics can really make a huge impact on anything you care about. So just trying to convince people, you know, your one vote can really make a difference, especially locally on who represents you.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
All right. So that was Hannah Testa. And again, she's 17 and she lives in Georgia. The way I know about Hannah is I'm working on yet another book about young women, Gen Z climate activists. And she's one of the people that's on my YouTube channel. So if you're interested in Gen Z or in climate change, I also have interviews with the 65 visionary scientists and some of my dance videos with John Piper of Downtown Dance. They moved to a new place above Woodstock's Pizza. So next month in August, we'll have Cynthia Selby. So I'm sorry about the mix-up at the beginning, but I'm glad you got to hear Hannah. Just to follow up, we talked about the Green New Deal and where Biden's position was on it. I think that's a really important issue, so I wanted to follow up with that. You may know about the Sunrise Movement. It's a group in Chico, mostly students, and it's a national U.S. climate activist group, and they are pushing really hard for the Green New Deal. They were the people who occupied members of Congress offices, and AOC was there and spoke, that kind of thing. So the Sunrise Movement has been pushing Joe Biden's campaign to take a really strong stand, a stronger stand on the environment than the Democratic committee was willing to do. So what they're working on for his platform is that we achieve 100% clean electricity by no later than 2035. 100% clean new buildings by 2030. And 100% clean vehicles as soon as possible. They would like to see green jobs with a climate core, because as you know, our infrastructure is really crumbly in terms of bridges and highways and old buildings. So we need to revamp our infrastructure in a green way. So we know that there's a huge unemployment problem right now, so that would I don't want to say kill two birds with one stone, because I don't want to really kill birds, but it would give people jobs and rebuild in a green way. And they also want to create, this is they, meaning the Sunrise Movement pushing Joe Biden's campaign, create an environmental justice fund to make historic investments in environmental justice projects. The young women that I'm interviewing for the climate activist book talk a lot about climate justice, because they want us to know that rich people can get away from the floods or the drought, but poor people can't. So there's a human rights, a justice issue involved in environmental change. So there would be a fund to invest in projects that would, like, clean up wastewaters, remediate lead in paint, ensure safe wastewater, water systems. You've probably heard about the little girl who started campaigning against lead in the water in Michigan. She started when she was 8, and so she's pretty amazing. Indigenous people's rights are part of environmental justice, having tribal sovereignty. I just heard on the news that the Supreme Court upheld tribals' right to something like half of Oklahoma in terms of old treaties that the court said should be validated. That's pretty amazing. So they would work with indigenous people, or what the Canadians call First Nations. And they would have a, what they call an equity screen. So all major federal spending projects on infrastructure would need to be environmentally sound, green, and take into account the human aspect. The Supreme Court just said that the Dakota Pipeline cannot go forward. So it's kind of amazing. We're seeing some bright spots, although the Trump administration has tried to, with executive orders, undo every environmental program that President Obama put in place. So there's little bright spots in the midst of all this. Another platform that I think Biden signed off on was to hold polluters accountable. So corporate executives would be accountable for the safety of their workers and communities, and that fossil fuel companies would no longer be receive all kinds of tax breaks and benefits. I am thinking of Amazon and how the workers in the warehouses have complained about lack of safety precautions. So under this new policy, Amazon wouldn't be able to get away with that. And we know that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world, I think, now. So it's, you know, clearly he can afford to have safety measures in the plants. Sustainable environment is another one. This new Green Deal that Biden is involved with would plant over 16 billion trees by 2050, including in urban areas, and prioritizing communities of color and low-income communities to receive the trees. And it would also rebuild food infrastructure. You've probably heard about food deserts, where in urban areas, poor areas, people don't have access to anything but, you know, fast food and junk food. So they don't get proper nutrition. So there would be a local market infrastructure and more facilities for local farmers to sell produce directly, like we do in Chico at our farmers markets. And we know that these young people are fighting hard for the environment to try to make sure that they have a future where they can breathe and live and not be inundated by smog. It's kind of interesting that the positive effect of the virus has been you can see in Beijing now. It's not just a cloud of smog where you can't see someone a foot ahead of you like it is sometimes. So people are asking that we not go back to the normal. We go to a new normal where people live in an environment that's healthy. It's what we owe our children. Okay, so I wanted to encourage you to take a look on my YouTube channel for interviews with Hannah Testa and Cynthia Selby and others, and know that we're on the second Thursday of every month. So again, you're listening to KZFR Radio 90.1, Chico, the Foothills, and beyond. Stay tuned for Peanut Butter and Jelly Time. And do you want to say hi?
Hi, it's Terry here.
What are you going to start us off with, Terry?
Jungle Boogie, the Sippy Cups.
All right.
Should I go, Bill?
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, anybody hear any monkeys in the house? Anybody speak monkey? Because I need a translator. He speaks monkey. Okay, what about the rest of you guys? You want to learn to speak monkey? Yeah, okay. She's going to teach us, so you do whatever she says.